while since I did this.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, a peck of pickled peppers, Peter Piper picked, Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, where's the peck of pickled peppers Peter Piper picked?
Great, thanks. Hello, and welcome to On Repeat with Beth and Susanna. This is a frank and honest podcast about the reality of living with OCD. Disclaimer, we are not mental health professionals. Please visit OCD Action for services that can help and support you. We know it's been a while since we released an episode, but we hope everyone is doing okay during this weird lockdown time.
Before we crack on with today's conversation, we just want to express our support for the Black Lives Matter movement. As a mental health podcast, we'd like to take this opportunity to plug Black Minds Matter UK, a charity who work towards making mental health topics relevant and accessible for all Black people in the UK. They are currently raising money to enable as many Black people as possible to access specialised help. So to find out how you can receive therapy for free, please visit their website, which is linked in our show notes. We've also linked to their GoFundMe page, where you can donate to help provide more services to those in need.
Beth recorded today's episode a few weeks ago over Zoom due to currently being in lockdown.
Zoom, 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 we're going to the moon.
What?
Can I just say, what's happened to Skype?
Skype?
Yeah, because it feels like when lockdown happened, Skype, probably the people that own Skype were like, oh, this is our time. And it's just been completely shoved to the side.
My friends use Skype.
No, I don't know anyone that's using Skype. It's all Zoom. And I'd never heard of Zoom before this situation.
Yeah, but it's because it's mainly businesses, isn't it? So.
Okay. Anyway, how are you doing, Susanna, with lockdown?
I'm done with it now.
Yeah, I think everybody is.
I feel like we should just say we're recording this in week 10.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea, just to keep it, you know, people know where we're at. Yeah, we're in week 11.
Is it?
Oh, I mean, we're losing track.
Oh, yeah, I have lost track.
Yeah, how have you found it in terms of your OCD? Has it been what made it worse, or has it...
I think it's just left me with more time to think.
Yeah, so therefore...
everything.
Yeah, I agree. I found that... I've also found the fact that it's really uncertain time all around us. Everything's uncertain and wobbly.
Yeah.
It's like my OCD side of my brain, which I've decided I want to call Brian, by the
way. Oh, Brian the brain.
And I'll tell you for why. It's because I was messaging my friend about my brain, and I said, my Brian keeps saying to me... And then I thought, actually, that's quite a good name for
it. So you're going to name your OCD Brian.
Brian is the name now for... For ages, I used to call my OCD Frodo. Who's actually from Lord of the Rings.
He's a hobbit, yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't realise that. I thought it was the guy from Hunchback of Notre Dame who keeps Quasimodo upstairs in the church. That little church in Paris, you know,
just
what's
small,
it called?
Yeah.
But he's called Fromo?
I don't know.
Frollo, I think.
YOLO!
And so I called it Frodo for ages for that reason. Anyway.
Not YOLO.
But what was I saying about Brian? So Brian has been trying to find certainty in other ways, I think, and that's been very triggering for OCD. So I wonder if anyone else out there has been experiencing a similar thing.
Yeah, I have also found it, on one hand, quite nice in the sense that...
That's good.
I've had to not worry about trying to find a job I can handle, and I'm not having to worry about trying to keep up with everyone else.
Yeah.
Because that's a real big thing for me. I never want to be left behind.
Oh, God,
from
yeah,
my
same.
Friends.
FOMO.
I get major FOMO. I feel like we should do a whole episode.
We should do an
FOMO.
Episode about FOMO, because I think OCD can leave a lot of people with FOMO.
All
unfortunately.
The time.
It's weird because, yeah, actually, you're right. People aren't experiencing FOMO. I can't believe we're talking about FOMO this seriously, but it is a serious thing. People aren't experiencing FOMO.
Yeah.
During lockdown because there's nothing to get it. In case anyone doesn't know what that it stands for, it's fear of missing out.
Yeah. Unless you're not invited to a Zoom.
Oh,
or
that's
gotta
hurt. No one uses Skype anymore. I don't know
why. My friends use Skype.
What are they doing?
I don't know. It's really annoying because I don't have Skype.
Yeah, no one has Skype. What is that? That's really odd.
They're stuck in 2008.
Yeah. They're stuck in, like, when I was in a long-distance relationship at uni days. Yeah. That's what that reminds me of.
Early tens.
But, yeah, okay. So, and do you feel like, in terms of the lockdown easing, are you a bit more... is that causing anxiety for you?
Yeah, I think so, because it's, you know, everything that we're being told to do now by the government is stuff that you're trying to... you spent most of your life trying to train your brain...
not to do.
Not to do.
Yeah.
But also, I was reading a really good article by Mary Beard today.
I've heard of Mary Beard.
What a wonderful woman.
Who is she?
She's a historian. She does programmes on, like, the Romans and art and...
Beards?
Not beards. Shame. She has got great hair, though. But she was talking about how you're kind of comfortable now in lockdown.
Yeah.
And she's thinking, oh, I've got a bit too comfortable in not getting dressed and not having to, you know, make plans or...
Yeah, I was thinking earlier, I think a lot of people have felt like that. There's been less anxiety due to not having to make exciting plans or be
but
busy.
But then she was saying that she really misses going to the shops and things and, you know, having a nice brows or...
Yeah.
But she's very aware...
having nice brows? Because you can still have nice brows in lockdown, guys. Having, I tinted mine the other day.
Having a nice brows.
I was going to say, if there's one thing, you can have nice brows, plenty of time to work on them.
No, but she was saying that she misses going to shops. Like, she even misses getting the train. But she was saying she misses the train, the train as before.
I've been thinking about how the easing of lockdown, I'm finding that's a bit like, because then... because then you're kind of going, are the rules... you kind of feel a little bit more like more is left up to you to decide through your common sense.
Yeah.
That can be a bit anxiety-inducing for somebody with or without OCD, definitely with OCD.
I think I've kind of given myself the rule of if they don't explicitly say, you can do this, then I'm just not
doing it.
Doing it. That's because I don't want to... be like, oh, well, I made that decision to go and see this person. Or
but
that
that's
person.
When you get the FOMO, when you go to the park and you see a group of 20 people.
Yeah.
Also to do with therapy as well. Anybody that was in therapy or at the top of the list, which you obviously have had this experience. So
reached the top of the 10-month list during lockdown.
Oh,
which is
so
great.
So annoying.
And I'm now having to do it over video call, which...
yeah, how are you finding that?
It's awkward because, like I was saying to my friend the other day when we met, went for my first socially distanced walk, I was saying to her that it's talking to someone on the phone, not just in therapy but in general, is completely different to talking to someone in person. Because if you talk to someone in person, you can just chat about really random stuff, which doesn't necessarily have a point or a purpose. Whereas when you're on a phone, you feel like everything you say has to really kind of be going somewhere. But also in therapy, it's difficult because... your Wi-Fi is not always... they don't necessarily pick up on facial expressions or body language. So you have to really be, like, vocal.
Mm.
And, you know, you might not
want
be comfortable.
To in your house.
Yeah. Like, the other day, my therapist asked me something and I just went, as a response, I just made that noise. And he went, sorry, I didn't catch that. And I went, no, I just made a noise.
I just went,
yeah, I just made a negative sound. And he was like, right, okay, what? And I said, well, no, it was my answer, my gut reaction to what you just said. But if you'd seen me in person, it would have, I feel like, made more sense. You'd have seen my whole facial expression. Whereas over a dodgy internet connection, he just said, meh. This is someone you've never met before who you're now having to spill everything to.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like it always feels kind of less like you're actually having therapy because you're not going out and leaving the house. It doesn't feel like an actual thing.
Yeah.
It feels kind of abstract.
Right.
It's kind of an abstract thing because it's not... actually physically you going out to a therapist sitting down in a safe space, a space that's not filled with all of your emotions and all of your stuff from to begin with and not all your kind of general life clutter, and you're not kind of thinking, oh, can my parents hear me talking? You know, I have to come out of this therapy session straight into faces of my family.
Yeah, you don't have time to, like, just go for a walk. Yeah. Well, you could go for a walk, but you're going to have to.
You have to go, sorry, I'm going for a walk now. Yeah, yeah. You have to have some kind of chat, whereas when I had therapy before, I would travel into town on the bus, and that would take...
You got time to think about it.
That bus journey was, like, an hour and a half. It was so long. But it meant that I didn't have to talk to anyone or see anyone for... the time around the session, and it was, that's quite nice.
Are you finding it helpful at all?
I think so, but I think it would be better if it was in person. I think I would be
and
engaging
you've waited
with
so
it more.
Long.
Yeah.
I wonder if anyone else is having, well, I'm sure they are, similar experiences. Be interesting to hear from any listeners that maybe have had a similar experience.
But talking of dodgy connections.
Yeah.
Should we get back to today's episode?
That was a dodgy connection. By the way, your hair is looking great.
Thanks. That is a really dodgy connection.
Yeah, right. Your lockdown is doing wonders for your barnet. Let's get back to talking about the actual episode.
Yeah. So we apologise in advance for the sound quality.
Yeah.
Beth isn't the most technical, but she says she is learning.
I don't think I am.
You're trying.
Yeah, I'm trying. It's not top notch, but I like to think the conversation was. So I chatted to the wise and wonderful Ashley Curry, a recovered OCD sufferer and advocate for the charities OCD Action and Maternal OCD. We discussed parental OCD, opening up the conversation of mental health for men, coping with lockdown anxiety, and how, for some people at least, CBT really can be the answer to living a life free from OCD. Feels like you can't start a conversation at the moment without being like, how are you doing in this current situation?
Actually, isn't it? Oddly enough, I'm doing really well. I think experience in OCD and then going through the CBT has given me a lot of tools to, you can't deal with uncertainty. A lot of people now are in massive uncertainty stages, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's sort of that little bit of experience has given you a bit of foundation and platform. So, right, well, we can't control what's going to happen. What we can do is stick to the guidelines, stick to what we can do best, and then, look for that tunnel, that light at the end of the tunnel. It's quite similar, isn't it? Because I've been a barber for 35 years. So when the shop had to close, I was quite tearful. For me, that's my life. You know, that is me. That is my happy place. So, yeah, quite emotional then, but you just carry on now. You've had to take one day at a time, haven't you? I've been getting lots of videos of people cutting their own hair. People look to become a barber, aren't they?
You're probably seeing
the tough part is... Yeah, I mean, I had a friend whose dad died about a week ago, and he's been a regular customer every 2 weeks for 30 years, and he's desperate for a haircut for the funeral, and I've had to say, no, you literally have to decline it. Tough.
Yeah, really tough. But you feel like maybe having the tools that you've learned through having CBT are coming in useful?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Because you're an advocate, obviously, for OCD Action.
And maternal OCD as
And maternal OCD. So there's so much I want to ask you. How did you come to working with OCD Action? What was the journey leading you there?
Initially, on recovery, when I was diagnosed in 2005, I did a little piece for OCD UK. And that was a radio programme. It was an opportunity to discuss the type of thoughts I was having that other people never spoke openly about. So it was like a foundation there to say that people do have these horrible sexual intrusive thoughts, fears of harm in their babies. And it sort of opened up opened a gate for me from there. And from that point, I just went on. I mean, it's been 15 years now doing talks, research, crossed paths with OCD Action via Maria and Diana from Maternal OCD.
Mm-hmm.
Because they decided to set up this organisation, which was just, I mean, through my talks and stuff, you start to notice that women were getting more severe OCD during pregnancy, and research now tells us that yes, it's quite, you're more likely to get OCD during and after pregnancy than you are in normal life. So there's a higher rate, risk on mums and some fathers recording cases. So it's been quite an interesting journey. I've been keynote speaker at the conference a couple of times.
Amazing.
And any media work I always do, even if it's not directed at me from OCD Action, I always go through OCD Action and tell them what I'm doing.
That's cool.
It's important when the message goes out that it's done correctly. And I've also been a guest speaker at the Maternal Mental Health Alliance, which is a national body that's taken on anyone's, perinatal birth trauma. They oversee, what their aim was because of the lack of mother and baby units in the UK. They're trying to turn the map green, and we're doing a good job of that. Working with Dr. Fiona Chalicombe, who's a specialist perinatal OCD, We now have a centre at the Cabot in London, which is specifically aimed at mums and dads and partners, children up to the age of three or during pregnancy. So they access CBD much quicker, and it's done in an intense period
rather than
doing it over 6 months. Yeah. It's got a good success rate. So basically, you're just shutting down for 30 days. Forget the rest of the world.
Really?
You're going to focus on getting you better from OCD.
You almost want someone to do that. You want someone to go, right, you're shut. We're taking you for 30 days and we're going to do hardcore therapy.
Absolutely. What do we say? Is it average 13 years before someone accesses correct treatment, reaching out, diagnosis, going through hoops, getting into the access and getting that correct treatment?
It's
quite a long journey, isn't it?
Yeah.
So part of my work was to get them years reduced. We don't want people losing 12 years of their life. If someone's got early symptoms of OCD, we can get them in there early and give them the tools.
That's fantastic. And that leads me to asking you actually about how long was it before you were diagnosed, because it came on, didn't it, once you were a father?
Yeah. So I had it on and off through my life. So we call it sort of like a wax and wane. So you'd have spells of OCD episodes, and then you'd have 6 months free.
Yeah.
And a new variant would come in. And then it was if I had my own inbuilt CBT system when I was younger. You were worrying about these things and, you know, constantly ruminating fear. But I used to say to myself, why are you worrying so much about this? You're not getting anywhere by doing these behaviours. So it was like in the end, it literally takes over. So you get to that crisis point, lost 2 stone in weight, went from working 8 hours a day to 2, have the breakdown, get this diagnosis at the age of 35. And that was a light bulb moment. Mm. But thankfully, I suppose for me, I didn't have a lot of collateral damage, which a lot of people do with OCD. Mm. I managed to carry on through life.
It sounds like you were managing it yourself for a really long time.
Yeah. And then I got to that point of crisis where I couldn't cope anymore.
Yeah.
You know? And it was an evil, debilitating illness, isn't it?
Oh, that's awful.
That diagnosis was like, there it is. You know, and even though you do get a diagnosis of OCD, in typical OCD fashion, it responded by saying, well, perhaps they're just making it up.
Yeah.
Lying. So, you know, that led on to me avoiding therapy. So I thought, if I go to therapy, they're going to lock me away. So I did research CBT, and that's where I discovered Paul Self Hospice work, you know, about how CBT works with OCD. And I walked it. I walked the talk and had to go through things I wouldn't normally do.
Mm.
One of the important things I always thought was that, and when I teach therapists now, is that when you help someone to get better from OCD, you sort of say to them, well, we know where you are at the moment is a pretty shit place.
Yeah.
Right. So what we're going to do is we're going to try something different for the next 3 months.
And just see.
And this is our goals, yeah. And do these things. And if it doesn't work, we'll go back to where you are now.
Interesting.
And that's to try and get that person engaged with the belief that therapy will help.
So you're a real believer in CBT. It really worked for you, didn't it?
And you had to do things that you were avoiding, doing the opposite of what it demanded. So you would say, well, actually, it's time to do these things in this way. You know, I'm not doing the things I should be doing. So I need to regain my life back.
Yeah.
I need to have this point where I want to be able to go and do things where the OCD is preventing me from doing things. Yeah. Sex as and everyone around you. It's just me. It was the wife, the kids. You know,
yeah.
So.
Yeah.
The whole caboodle, isn't it?
Yeah, and we know that, you know, when it's really bad, even knowing that it's having that effect on your loved ones around you, you still feel like you can't do anything to change it.
Exactly.
Even though you desperately don't want them to
be. And that adds into the pot, doesn't it? Because you know your behaviours and your OCD, you know you don't want it, but you're obviously too afraid to do things differently.
Yeah.
But then, because you're having effects on everyone around you, that adds further stress into the equation, which causes further the loss of self-worth, isn't it? The guilt feelings,
awful, you know,
everything,
yeah,
that pot.
I'm really interested in the work you do with mums and dads, because it makes sense why that would be a time that OCD might arrive for the first time for somebody, or at least become noticeable.
I think with perinatal OCD and paternal OCD, obviously it's natural instinct for any human being to be use safety behaviours for a baby, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, doing the things that you should be, oh God, you know, did I wash that bottle out once, or you know, I better give it another rinse just in case. It's then when it takes over, that point where it, you know, did I put 8 scoops of milk in, or did I put 9? Now, if I put 9 in, the baby could die.
Yeah.
Theoretically, the baby probably wouldn't die, but OCD
what if
make you think that.
Yeah.
What if Mum's mum's breastfeeding, and the person was sleeping, to think, and wonder if the partner's sexually enjoying breastfeeding. I bet she is, actually, isn't she? So you're then thinking, hold on, this is an interesting thought, isn't it? How do I ask someone that question? Well, you don't, do you? But you're ruminating about it.
Was it difficult to come out and talk about that when you first were experiencing it? And I assume it
must, I think so. But then I think once the diagnosis was in place, it was like, okay. So you could all come in together and work together and say, well, this is why, that was why you were like that 20 years ago. You know, you get married. Well, when you get married, you're obviously going to be very doubtful, am I making the right
decision? Yeah, of course.
But not for a month before, sleepless nights, going over and over. That's the differential. I think when I do talks, it's like, you know, when I say about people go out and have a really good drinking session, the next day it's not uncommon for them to have a little bit of anxiety. And then they try to recall the previous night's events, but because the alcohol's blocked it, they then end up texting people. Did I do? So, but that only temporarily lasts probably for a day or 6-7 hours for that person. Mm-hmm. Who are never drinking again.
Yeah. See?
But for us, that's constant, isn't it? It's a daily occurrence.
That is such a good analogy. It's so interesting because I still struggle with my OCD. I was diagnosed age 10. I have had CBT, several rounds of it. I'm on medication, but I do have times where I feel almost like it's not there. And then what I find so frustrating actually is how lockdown for me has actually triggered OCD a bit, which I wasn't expecting, because when coronavirus started to be a thing, I was really calm about it, whereas I had friends who were freaking out and I was very like, no. But I think what it's done instead is it's clung to other things. So I'm not obsessing about coronavirus, but I'm certain other parts of my life it's then. And what it does is it will take over so much to a point where I'll get to the kind of like the breakdown point, and it'll be then that I go, oh my God, this is OCD. But it's been weeks of me. So I love listening when I've heard you talk at conferences, because you are so positive about recovery being possible. I find that very hopeful as somebody who at the moment doesn't know how that would manifest.
See, it's interesting because like when you do the therapy stuff, teaching, it's like a lot of people were probably yourself, probably gone, had CBT, then you're expected to do the homework over the next week on your own. What you find, sometimes people give an exposure thing to do for that following week.
Yeah.
And then they find they just can't do it. So they feel that they're not achieving anything. So when you go back, therapists say, well, we've tried that. Let's ignore that for now. Let's try something different. So by doing different things, the thing that you were struggling with, all of a sudden can become less problematic because you try something different. And the thing you were trying to be then becomes, actually, I don't need to do that anymore. I don't need to go that whole, down that route anymore. Because I know it's OCD. I'm not doing the compulsions anymore. So sometimes we get these tasks to do. Oh, yeah, I've got to do this. And then when I go back to the therapist, well, I tried, you know. And so what? It doesn't mean you failed.
That's interesting.
It just means that route's not worked.
Because sometimes you can go, oh, I didn't manage to do that one thing that the therapist said I should expose myself to, so now it will never go away.
So imagine then the next two sessions you go off and do something else. The first one you've really struggled with, actually, I don't need to do that anymore because things I've done have made that a lot easier to understand. Because obviously nature of as yourself and anyone who's had OCD wants to get rid of it. They want to be better. They want to go, why can't I just be
like normal? My friend,
keep working. You go out and, you know, drink out of a glass and not worry whether someone's put drugs in it. On the ERP bit was the expectancy. I wanted it to be there, you know. So if I went out and I said, I'm deliberately going out to do that because I know when I get to that glass, OCD is going to have a field day, but I don't give a monkey's.
Yeah.
I'm going to do the opposite. Where normally I would have drunk and thought, oh, damn, someone's put poison in there or some form of drug. Run up the toilet, deliberately vomit, come back, you know, order another drink so I can visually see that
it's okay.
That was probably triggered by someone saying, oh, you have to be careful leaving your drink on it.
Yeah.
Because someone might put something in it, you know. So that boom, straight away. Like my mum said, you were the last of four boys. I always wanted a girl. I've become a trans. So at night I would be checking myself. So would you do that now as a person who's recovered? No, because I don't have that. Whoa, you know, this is hitting me like a ton of bricks anymore.
Okay.
Very rarely get an intrusive thought, which bothers me. But like we say in the talks, when you are doing CBT, say, for instance, you're washing your hands 8 hours a day and you've got it down to three or two, 6 hours there, you've got replaced with good stuff.
Mm.
Replace the negatives with the positives.
That's amazing.
And as Paul says, always have that have a goal, not a goal setting, but looking for something you can do in the end, which OCD has prevented you from doing. The lady at the conference, she was 50, she always wanted to be a school teacher. She never believed she would be. Paul said, if we do the CBT, now she's a headmistress. So she's achieved what OCD prevented. Yeah, it is hard, CBT, for some people. Mm. Other people, like Diana from maternal OCD, had it for 19 years. Mm. 5 sessions of CBT, she was fully recovered.
Incredible.
Intense CBT, yeah.
Actually, you do still get thoughts, but...
but they're very brief, aren't they?
Yeah.
You don't even notice them. It's like, I think the average brain gets 11 million thoughts a day. If you ask me to think, when's the last time I had an intrusive thought? I can't remember. Because they're so brief. It's like, yeah, you hold a knife in the kitchen. Oh, I can stab the wife now, which everyone gets, and it's gone. But
yeah.
Some of them OCD would then react, wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm. And then it kind of puts the importance on it. The only thing I can do which helps me with that is to look at, because my OCD will be about lots of different things, when I'm worrying about something else, I can look back and go, oh, like, I don't even worry about that. So I could have those thoughts and not even notice them now. Whereas in terms of, like, the thing that I'm now worrying about, those thoughts are really obvious, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So a lot of people say that, oh, you know, why can't I have them ones back? Because they're easy to
Oh, my God, yeah, definitely, yeah.
That's because you've got the knowledge that it's daft.
Yeah.
You know, it's daft. But when you're in the grips of the new type comes along, you're like...
Yeah. With paternal OCD, is it something that a lot of dads might be struggling with but not speaking openly about?
Obviously, more prevalent in mums.
Right.
I think that's to do with the biological changes, isn't it? Having the baby going through pregnancy. With fathers, they, like I said, I mean, I met one friend, I met one guy on Twitter from my work who had never had OCD before in his life.
Yeah.
When the baby came along, that then kicked in. You know, I'm having these intrusive thoughts of harming, or, you know, lots of different things were going on. But because he knew, or once he learned why it was happening and he knew it was OCD, it made him much more relieved. You know, the relief there was like, I'm not a risk, I'm not a danger.
Right.
Having that CBT was really quick, you know, and helpful for him. But there are cases, I do a lot of work with Dr. Andy Myers from Bournemouth University and Mark Williams, who's a mental health advocate for fathers, particularly on postnatal depression in fathers, which we know is now 1 in 10 men as a father. You know, he just said 10 years ago, dads get postnatal depression. Well, actually, yeah, they do.
Mm.
So I've been involved with research into that. We've sort of, they've included the OCD part of, well, yeah, the Royal College of Psychiatrists said there's recorded cases of dads having paternal OCD.
And do you think, is it something that maybe a lot of men might be struggling with, that, but they feel they can't kind of...
open up.
Yeah, because they don't want to make it about them and they don't want to kind of...
So that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing with Mark and Andy. We're trying to bring in, like, a 5-minute screening test for fathers. Like when my first child was born, he was 11 pounds, emergency cesarean, watched it all, you know. I didn't have any birth trauma. A lot of men get birth trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder afterwards.
Wow.
Yeah, very, very common that. But never once was I asked, how's dad?
Are you okay?
You know, midwife would come round, health visitors would come round, put the kettle on ash, how's mum doing? Yeah. Let's look at dads and say, you know, how are you doing? How's dad?
Yeah.
Simple question. If you have the information to hand during pregnancy, some dads might get postnatal depression, some dads might get OCD, some might get, you know, birth trauma experiences.
Yeah.
So, but if they're aware, then they'll understand that this is what could happen. So some of the work we've been doing.
Yeah, to lessen the stigma as well, I guess, because I think there's probably still quite a big, you know.
Yeah, man up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the dad, I'm the breadwinner.
Mm.
Yeah. The one well I had was like when the son came in, it definitely wasn't my son.
Really?
You end up checking for signs, you know, the ears, the eyes. Oh, the eyes are blue. Well,
oh, my God.
Children's eyes are blue. But yeah. So that, you know, it will pick on the thing you most love. And you find 99.9% of all OCD subs are morally brilliant. Their moral compass is set so high. As Paul Sarkozka says, if he was to have one baby, six children, it would be someone with OCD because they're the safest people to have around. No recorded cases ever of anyone acting on their obsessional thoughts.
Yeah, but you can guarantee that someone listening to you saying that might be having OCD about that will go, but what if I do?
Yeah, but then that's the part of the CBT kicks in as well. You know, you're going to get a response. I always liken it to playing tennis against, say, for instance, what's his name, Roger Federer.
Mm.
You wouldn't beat him, would you? But every time the ball comes back, you will keep attempting and attempting. You know there's no end to you're not going to win.
Never ever. You can't beat it in that. If you
but
do
you're
it like that,
to, aren't
yeah,
you? A natural safety seeking behaviour is reassurance. Yeah,
100%
certainty.
Yeah, I think that's what going on to the current in terms of the work that you've been doing since the coronavirus crisis has hit. Do you think people are struggling more with their OCD?
I think there's been a general increase of people with OCD contamination, mainly. And then you've got, obviously, there'll be new types of thoughts of, have I harmed someone? Did I brush against someone? So that could then wreak havoc. There is reported cases of people's OCD is a lot better since COVID's come along. Because obviously, if you're contained into a position of not being able, say, like, some people's OCD is quite outside stuff, isn't it? So if you're inside your house, you sort of like becoming it's becoming a compulsion in itself because I'm in a safe zone, am I?
Yeah.
I'm not going out hurting anyone. So sometimes some people's OCDs become a little bit less.
Right, from being inside.
Concerning for mums, you know, especially newborns, with the increase of fears of harming. Mm. With me, it was like, when I looked at the statistics and I thought, actually, it's only 98.5% of people who get it get mild cases, don't they? But the OCD will pick on the 1.5%.
Yeah. Of course, yeah.
And I've been looking at words that the press have been using, which can influence anxiety. Maybe, probably, you know, there's no definite.
That's so true.
What they say.
Yeah.
So the words they use, I look at them, oh dear, imagine having OCD and then words come in. Maybe you could have.
This is what I've definitely been finding. It's the uncertainty of this situation. Yes.
That level of risks, you've got evaluation of safety seeking and risk levels are going to go quite high for a lot of people, aren't they?
Yeah.
Without reassuring, I suppose if you've been locked down or kept yourself away from people for the last 6 weeks, it's not reassurance, it's putting a normalisation of this is what's happened. Now, what is the correct behaviour to reintroduce yourself into society? Which would be OCD behaviours? You know, well, I can't go and see my mum because if I do that, she's over 60.
Yeah.
It all goes off on this tangent, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's interesting what you said about the words that the press are using, so the probably, maybe, these uncertain things that you cannot know for sure. And I think that's what's causing myself a lot of anxiety, and I imagine other people, is the feeling that, and it's classic OCD, that you can't know. So you can't know if you walking past that old man, even if you're socially distancing, you can't know whether you've passed on something to him.
Did I cough? Did I breathe heavily as I passed?
And you'll never know. Ooh. You'll never know if that man has got it, died, not got it, survived. Like, you're just doing a little poem there. But you can't know. And that it could drive
the uncertainty.
Yeah, it could drive you, if the OCD wedged in, it could drive you absolutely bonkers, couldn't it?
You could also end up withdrawing totally, couldn't you? Say, well, I'm not going out for 3 months now. Because if I do, X, Y, Z may happen.
So what would you say to someone that might be listening that maybe has reacted like that with their OCD, that maybe has gone, I need to shut away and not face this?
If you've had CBT in the past, knowledge, you know, do I want to be here for 2 months? Attempting to eliminate risk. So we say attempt to eliminate risk means you lose the ability to function. So if you're not, you know, if you want to not be functioning, then you're going to have to do these behaviours, which is the opposite to what you are actually is demanding. Again, it's that step, leap of faith, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even if that meant literally just walking down your garden path and touching the garden post and then walking back, then extending it, still you get desensitised to it, don't you?
Yeah, it's building it up. For somebody that maybe they've not realised they've got OCD before, or maybe they've had OCD but they've managed it, they've never had any help, but they're finding now it's they're kind of being alone for so long is making them, you know, aware of it. What do you think would be the best step for them to take whilst not being able to kind of go out and go to the doctors and stuff like that?
I think you can self-refer, can't you, to IAPT?
Yeah, I think you can.
Access to psychological therapists.
Okay.
And I think they're doing Skype sessions, aren't they? So that would be beneficial. You don't even have to go to your GP to get self-referral. You can self-refer yourself, can't you? And also reach out for support, use OCD Action, use recognised places, and they'll support you, give you tips and ideas what you can do.
Yeah,
you're not alone. That's the most important thing. You're not alone. You may feel you are, but you're not.
This is what's been interesting about lockdown, hasn't it? You kind of, everyone's gone into their own little small worlds,
And then, because what's been interesting as well is for someone like Susanna who has contamination OCD, she's been like, it's really interesting seeing the world start to behave in the way that I behave.
Suitability, yeah.
Yeah.
So she's like, actually, because, I mean, they're not obviously not, they're not debilitated, but they're acting in a way that's stopping prevention and seeking, yeah, safety, yeah, seeking behaviours.
It's very safety seeking, isn't it? Yeah. And it has to be, yeah, done, of course, but it is that thing of, yeah, we must do this. And it's the responsibility thing as well, like, you know, stay home, save lives. That, yeah, like, hits to the core, I think, if you've got OCD about hurting others, because you go, oh my God, how am I going to know? Like, maybe I can't go and get that, you know.
What if? Yeah.
Food, exactly. Or, yeah. It's the bloody so what
see,
if.
See, like with my daughter's been like, well, you mustn't go to Tesco's dad because I'm not vulnerable, but I'm a higher risk than what she is. So she's prepared to do the risk.
Yeah. Yeah.
On her behalf. So she's acting in a way which is quite a little bit behavioural in a sense of like
trying to control.
At least. At least mum and dad will be safe, yeah.
Yeah.
So everyone's acting in a way, you know, to eliminate the risk, aren't they?
How do you, this might be a bit of a woolly question, it's a bit fluffy. I just don't know how to be okay with the uncertainty. I find it so difficult. Like, it's so, the feeling is so overwhelming sometimes, not necessarily about the current situation, but whatever my OCD is focused on.
Yeah.
That uncertainty, I've ended up using this as like a personal therapy session. How do you sit with that uncomfortable uncertainty? Like, do you think it's distraction? Is it just
distraction helpful? So you've got this intrusive thought, it's causing a massive doubt and uncertainty. So obviously the next stage is the compulsive side, isn't it? Well, I must, you know, I'm gonna have to do this because I need to know for certain. So you're getting into that vicious circle again, aren't you, where we call it the vicious flower, isn't it, where, yeah, you go, thoughts, images, then I'll do the compulsions and I get that bit of relief and then back again.
Yeah.
So it's breaking that circle. So sitting with uncertainty is difficult, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, where you're done, you know, I think 99% of people know why they're having the intrusive thoughts.
Yeah.
They know why they're having images. They've got OCD. Then they become really uncomfortable with this, you know, oh God. And then there's this, like, I suppose it's like a gamble, isn't it? I think, I really must... oh no, I'll do it just in case.
Yeah.
This time.
Or you think, I'm going to have a really shit day if I don't get that reassurance. So I'm just going to, because a lot for me is to do with reassurance seeking. So I'm like,
I need to know.
I'll just get a friend to tell me that that's okay. And then I'll have a nice day and, you know.
Phew. Yeah. All right now for a bit. And then
it's worse.
Literally. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's resistance, isn't it? It's being able to resist that urge. So you get the urge, so you get this urge to ask.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think what you have to do is sort of go, why am I asking for? Mm. So I've had the thought, and I'm now going to get this urge. I know why I'm getting the urge, because I suffer with OCD. So when the urge comes, I'm going to have to say to myself, I'm going to have to sit here with the uncertainty. Let it rise, because anxiety always goes down, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The uncertainty levels in the end go down. So during that point, it's how long you can sit with it, sitting with the anxiety, uncertainty, say 1 or 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Then carry on and do something different.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you'll start seeing this, like, actually, this isn't bothering me so much. You know? And I used to play Pac-Man for hours.
I love Pac-Man.
And I think, actually, that's quite odd, because the last 2 hours I haven't thought about OCD.
Interesting.
I haven't thought about it, because you're doing something different.
So everyone needs to download Pac-Man. that's the advice.
I'm addicted. But you're like, I suppose the most important thing is you still got to do the exposures, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
To a degree. You still got to go, well, I can't see a Pac-Man the rest of my life, because
I'm
not going to get anywhere. So do have things you want to do yourself as well, pleasurable things. You may not even feel like it, but even go for a walk, do little tiny things, you know, can make you feel a lot better in yourself, can't it?
Yes,
it is hard. It's crippling.
Sometimes, you know,
Well, it's interesting, because when I work with Rob Wilson, who's another expert, we did some work in Surrey University. Basically, what we do, we train therapists. So if you've got a 30 in a group, one of the tasks, what we always say with therapists, don't ask someone to do an exposure if you're not prepared to do it yourself. So the exposure was that you had to write down the person you most loved, might be your wife, your child, and then you have to write down that you hope that they die in a road accident.
I've had to do that
before. Sign and date it. So out of the 30 in the room, five of them automatically said, can't do it, because you've put them into a position of what it's like to have OCD yourself. So I'm uncertain. I can't do that possibly. Yeah. They're people without OCD, so they've got to get used to doing that with the client. I think about half an hour later, we stopped the session and said, does anyone else know? Two had rubbed the names out, and one had actually texted his wife already just to check she was okay. Yeah, so that's that borderline, how close people are, isn't they, to that uncertainty.
Maybe it's in a lot of people, because superstition is a bit like OCD, really, isn't it?
Yeah, can't walk under a ladder because my mum might die. Well, I always do it deliberately.
Yes, deliberate I do now.
So I'm always deliberate. What you have to be careful with, when you've had good CBT, say, for instance, you do get something like a cough, and you think, well, I'm not going to go to doctors, it's just a cough. And someone previous to health anxiety, you go, oh, I've got lung cancer. So you CBT can sometimes sort of have that little effect of thinking, well, actually, I don't need to go because I know it's just a cough.
Yes.
Realistically, if it remains persistent, then you do have to go.
Yeah.
With CBT, like, it's a bit, I've been a little, not blasé, but I've been quite full on with the COVID, you know, again, I've been totally opposite, realistically, but sensible. So, I mean, I think OCD action and a lot of therapists produce stuff. Now you can change if you're going through that type of CBT where you are having to go out and do things. You can't literally do that anymore, can we?
No.
Or can we do things and touch things and then wash our hands for 20 seconds afterwards instead of 20 minutes? That's the differential, isn't it? But I've been to Tesco's, I've used the shopping trolley. Now, how long should I wash my hands afterwards? But normally in this type of situation, previous to COVID, I used to wash them for half an hour till they bled.
Yeah.
You know, so I've been to Tesco's, I've done my bits. What do I do now? Good exposure. Wash for 20 seconds.
Yeah,
sufficient. And then do the other stuff you want to carry on doing it.
Yeah.
Don't have a strip wash and, you know, prevent the risk from happening.
Have you found speaking out about having OCD and kind of talking about CBT so much, is that, do you find that helpful to you mentally, or is it, does it sometimes kind of trigger a bit of that kind of OCD again?
No, not really, no. Well, as in doing normal talks and
talking about OCD so much.
Yeah, I have breaks. It's important to have a break because you don't want to be, I always say, you don't become obsessed with the obsessive. So just sit back and have your break. And luckily with OCD action, I have access to support systems there. If I need it, I never have, but I recognise the signs. And you look at it and you think, well, I've stayed around 15 years carrying on doing this work. I think it needed to be done at the time, you know, and then to push on. And now you've seen all that change. So many people talking openly. And you look back and think, yeah, it's been worth it.
Yeah.
I mean, I even worked with Rosie on the book Pure, you know, it went into the
city. Yes.
There's a paragraph in the book my story. Yeah, we worked together. It's interesting, but good on her, you know, when I first met her, coming out of the woods. Now she's, you know, made this book and
amazing.
Gone on leaps and bounds. Yeah,
it's such fantastic. A good TV programme. Yeah.
It is so nice to see. It gives me, like, quite humbling that people can just literally talk quite openly about OCD compared to where we were 15 years ago.
What's your opinion now on the name Pure OCD?
I'm still anti pure OCD.
Yeah, are you?
I mean, it's funny because when I was diagnosed, I came across Dr. Phillips' video, and he was the first person who ever, I think, used the term pure.
Yeah.
And it was just a way of describing, I think, what it was like. It was like a platform for the thoughts that people never discussed, really. You know, the sexual injury thoughts, harming, did I kill my dog, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So it was like a platform, but when you talk to people, say, like, well, I've got pure O. And then you go, look, you know, I did the NHS talk when you were in the audience. And then when you actually tell them what's actually happening, it's still OCD. And I wrote a blog, you know, it's same meat, different gravy. It's just, you know, I talked to a chap on Twitter the other day. He said, oh, my counsellor said, you know, I've got pure O. And I said, well, oh, I don't have any compulsions. So we haven't got OCD. And when you break it down, he goes, oh, yeah, actually, I do seek reassurance. I do Google. I do research stuff. And so everything's there. If that gives people comfort, helps them on the recovery, then yes. But as a medical term, not recognised. I actually had what Adam Radamski's done research on. It was what we call mentally contaminated. So you feel dirty inside. So you know, where someone's hands feel dirty, you actually feel. So what I was trying to flush it out with water. So I was cleansing myself internally just to get rid of the dirty feeling. Another compulsion. And also you can find people with contamination. When they're out in public, they're probably less likely to show their visual compulsions. So they might end up doing it internally. They might say, well, if I count to 20, that's going to prevent that from happening. So a lot of people do the hidden ones as well as the open ones. But yeah, you do get people very hard to spot their compulsions, doing them internally.
Inside.
And that's where the therapist steps in and says, what are you doing when this happens?
Yeah, and it can be very sneaky when it kind of goes, but that's normal. It's normal to want to Google if your mole is weird. You have to kind of not allow yourself even those like tiny things that you can justify. Because then it gets out of control.
Yeah. When it goes from 1 to 20, isn't it? If you Google a mole, which is natural, we don't know about mole, Google that. Yeah, you'll see the images come up. Well, let's click on that one.
Yeah, then that one.
An hour and a half later, your images is anything.
Awful.
Still no resolution.
It's so interesting to me that I've been dealing with this for 17 years and I still get caught up in its web. I understand it now so well and I know what it's doing, but it's still gets me. Just like,
I think also what's important is, from what I've learned, is that a lot of people don't just have OCD alone. Mm. They have other things running alongside: depression, social anxiety, generalized anxiety disorder. So we say with therapists is that it's no good treating the OCD on its own.
Yeah,
because CBT won't work. You've got to treat the big picture. Someone's depressed, you have to treat the depression or the OCD, because if you treat the OCD, depression's not be stopping the CBT from working, and vice versa. I always say it's like peeling an onion, treat the big picture, not just the OCD.
This is a big, big old question for you. I promise I'm not reassurance seeking. I'm just intrigued. Do you believe, obviously it's just, you know, matter of opinion, but do you believe that everybody has the capacity to live an OCD-free life?
Everyone's unique, aren't they? I mean, if CBT was so successful, then OCD wouldn't exist, would it?
Mm.
If you look at that.
Yeah, that's true.
Got a good success rate. But it's all dependent also on the person who's implementing the therapist, mm-hmm. who's implementing. That said, you could get one of the best ones in the world, but it doesn't mean you can work together. Therapy is a collaboration, is it? You're two experts. You're the expert of the illness. Collaboration is an important part, isn't it? If you don't get on with your therapist, it's not going to work, is it? You know, it's tough. Therapists will cry with someone. They're going for a journey together, aren't you? You know, they have emotions as much as what we do.
Do you think if somebody has really tried with CBT, there might still be a chance that they just need to give it another shot with the new therapist?
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Just because it's not worked before doesn't mean it wouldn't work if you tried again. Many reasons why at the time, isn't it? Someone might not be in that right frame. I think they did. I don't know if they still recommend it, but not to change medication or dosages during CBT. So if you're on medication, you're quite stable. There's no point. But sometimes when you increase the medication, it can increase the anxiety and thoughts. So someone also discussed, I don't know the statistics, was that when you're doing CBT with meds, is it different to doing it without medication?
Mm.
You know, is that point of you going through anxiety stuff? Is it the meds that are helping you, or is it?
Yeah, but I know for me, when I was really ill, I needed the meds to then allow me to do the CBT.
Go into that zone, yeah. A lot of people find them so beneficial.
So beneficial,
Just... Don't be afraid to try them. You know, that's one of my big qualms. I never got on with them, but I wouldn't say to people, don't try them. They're, you know, administered correctly and followed through properly, they can be really beneficial. People that have gone through CBT, gone really well, got better, they've decided to come off the, say, sertraline, which they have done. No, see, intrusive thoughts coming back.
That was me.
So then up the medication again, thoughts become less.
Yeah,
so
you can get into a bad headspace of going, but maybe that's not me that's doing the work. Yeah. It's the medication and blah, blah. But you are still doing the hard work when you're...
Because you are.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you, lastly, what the... Again, it's probably a bit of a big question, but I was just going to ask you, I know you do a lot of, like how we came across you as a family was when my mum was looking for a support group as a carer of, or like a loved one of someone with OCD. For people right now that might be either living with somebody that is really struggling with their OCD, or possibly harder, knowing that they've got a loved one struggling with OCD that they can't get to and see.
That could be quite frustrating because it's difficult for both.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you had any words of kind of, I don't know, comfort or advice or...
Do what we're doing.
Yeah.
And then also, obviously, OCD Action run a carer support system, don't they? So you go on their Skype sessions once a week. So yeah, it must be really difficult.
Really tough.
I mean, my son can't come in. He's decided to lock down at girlfriend's. He pops over to drop some milk off, but he's not. Can't come in.
Oh. I know.
So you can imagine the impact as it's had on us as people who are, you know, normal.
Yeah.
It's quite tough.
But if you know that your loved one is, their OCD is really bad, or not just OCD, their mental health in general right now.
Yeah. That's very difficult.
But very just try and keep communicating, I guess, is the thing.
Yeah. Keep in touch. Contact, isn't it?
Yeah.
And let them know they're there. You know, let someone... Also, not it doesn't have to be a family member, does it? You know, but you can try and get a little support network going around as well.
Yeah.
Helping them make sure they are getting the help as well. You know, are they getting the food shopping? Are they getting things that they need?
It's a tough time, but like you say, maybe having the CBT tools and techniques is actually a positive and a blessing in disguise.
It has been tough though, because there is, you know, you do things that we find out you do half a job, you decorate the bedroom and you leave it half done, go back 10 days later. Realistically, a lot of things at the moment don't matter. Obviously, if you're financially okay, for us we're okay, that's it. But obviously I haven't worked for 6 weeks being self-employed, big impact. What I've done is I've brought it into a zone. Are we safe? Yes. Are we coping okay? Do we have food and water? We're fine. You know, that's how I've put it down to.
And in a way, that could be helpful in terms of tackling OCD, because it's making you kind of realise what...
The here and now, where we are. And
it's very much about trying to stay day by day. I keep having to go, no, focus on today.
I think with PTSD, they call it root. You know, like, make sure you've got roots coming out your feet. Grounding techniques. I'm here now. This is where I am at. Focus on my breathing, and this is what we're going to do. And give it 5 minutes and everything will calm down a little bit. Just, you've got to live that moment, haven't you, rather than go, well, what's it going to be like in a week's time? Mm-hmm. We cannot control that. Anything at the moment is uncontrollable by all of us, isn't it? And the uncertainty is uncontrollable. So, live that day. If not, live with each minute by minute. Take one thing at a time.
Thank you so much for listening. And as always, please check out OCD Action and OCD UK for support. We've linked both in our show notes below. You can find us on Twitter at RepeatPod1 and Instagram at OnRepeatPodcast. You can also email us your stories and feedback on repeatpod@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you.
Bye!
Bye! Please go for the bye.
Okay.